We've just dropped in on a preview of one of the performances that will be part of the upcoming Fringe Festival.
Everything real is hidden under layers of canned laughter!
The Fringe Festival gives actors and other performers in Kansas City a chance to experiment with new work.
Charlie Sheen's character from Two and a Half Men started getting emotional and talking about his feelings. It would make you uncomfortable.
Take, for example, the aria we're hearing right now about Charlie Sheen and uncomfortable feelings. It's an original composition by the Lyric Opera, the UMKC Conservatory, and teen playwrights at the Coterie. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're taking this moment with so much original new work being performed to talk about theatrical experimentation in Kansas City, because really, it happens all year long. With me in the studio is Heidi Van. She runs The Fish Tank, a 50-seat black box theater at 18th and Wyandotte. It's one of the main venues for riskier work here in town. Welcome to Central Standard, Heidi.
Thank you.
Rye Kincaid is also with us this morning. He's a local actor, playwright, and composer. Thanks for being here, Rye.
Thanks very much for having me.
You actually write more than plays. I remember a few years back you wrote a book called Sexy Cash.
That's true. That was some comic vignettes from a young up-and-coming person who thought he should put those all in a book.
The older version of that person, it sounds like, maybe doesn't agree.
Oh, they're all right. Some, they're still funny. But, yeah.
Kudos on your modesty.
Well, thanks.
But you also, you had a brief but very funny run for mayor.
I did. You didn't vote for me, Heidi.
I'm so sorry.
No one voted for me. But I wrote a funny song about it. And, I like to do experimental art of all sorts.
Yeah, that was sort of maybe a performance art experiment. Mm-hmm. What inspired you to turn your theatrical abilities toward a mayoral run?
It was during a Kansas City mayoral run. And I think it was the candidates all had funny names, I thought, or unusual names. So I was like, this is strange. I kind of have an unusual name, and I'm going to write a rock song about it. Rye Kincaid would make a kick mayor. I got a lot of hits on that, and it was fun. I listed all the great Kansas City things, and I deserve to be mayor because I barbecue. That was the bridge.
Those were your qualifications.
That's my qualifications right there.
Well, before we launch in, I want to hear a little bit about each of your specific projects that are in the Fringe Festival. We'll get to know you and what you do, and then we'll take on the larger topic of experimental theater in Kansas City. Sound good?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So, Heidi, you've got two plays in Fringe this season. One of them has a somewhat provocative title.
It does. One of the shows that I'm producing is called The Penis Monologues, and the title is a reaction. The title was conceived from the reaction that The Vagina Monologues has from its nearly 20-year run and part of the theatrical canon in the world, basically.
Explain what the Vagina Monologues performance is in case people aren't familiar.
The Vagina Monologues by Eve Ensler is a compilation of conversations and ideas and stories and experiences that she had, as well as curated stories from other people, about women and about their sexuality and about their identities based on their, you know, parts.
Well, how did you talk to me about the process of deciding to kind of spin that paradigm a little bit and take on the penis monologues?
I think part of the reaction of the vagina monologues, or part of what people may take away from the vagina monologues, is that the people talk about the vagina as this vulnerable, destroyable thing, but that penises can also be as delicate and fickle and destroyable, and they also have thoughts and feelings. And so Peregrine and I reached out to writers to...
That's Peregrine Honig, Peregrine your collaborator.
Honig, exactly. She's the artistic director of the production, and I'm the director of the performance. And so we reached out nationwide to writers to submit pieces on masculinity, on sexual identity, human behavior. Also, I did a lot of research about the evolution of male sex drive, the effects of certain foods or chemicals on male sex drive, just like researching the psychological, emotional, because I don't think men talk about these things.
I haven't yet.
Well, there's still time. You can submit
before
a monologue to me,
okay,
Rye.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, that is so. We have the male in the studio who has not talked about this yet, and I am curious about that. I mean, we've got two women collaborating on a show called The Penis Monologues, and The Vagina Monologues, part of the idea there really is that it's women telling the stories of their own bodies from their own perspectives.
Right.
Talk about this, I mean, how it has felt to you to curate, as a woman, these stories about the male body.
I'm nervous about it, and it's taught me a lot. I mean, there are things that I had no idea that men thought about, which is amazing. And it's given me a reverence and respect in a way that I hadn't experienced. I mean, I know it's out there, but I hadn't experienced this conversation with another human. So hopefully this performance is that opportunity to share these conversations with an audience. Our hope is that this project started in Kansas City, we can travel and tour and curate these conversations in other geographic locations.
Are the stories all from men or are some of them from women?
They're all from men.
What you mentioned that there are things you learned, and of course we're on the radio and everything has to kind of follow certain FCC regulations.
Sure, sure.
But have you learned anything new or had any major epiphanies that you'd be willing to share?
Yeah, and it's really simple. I didn't realize I didn't realize that men were vulnerable about their penis. And that's not funny, but it's like, I just didn't know. And I'm shocked. And like I said, a whole new kind of reverence. And yes, I just realized that I'm talking on the radio, not just to you and Rye. And so my mom's listening.
Yeah, that realization
happened
to me too.
Okay.
Well, so, and this is a collaboration with a visual artist, and you are a playwright, among many other things. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about the collaborative aspect of doing this, because that does seem to me to be a major hallmark of experimental work, is that it crosses artistic genres.
Absolutely. And I love working with Peregrine so much. Not only are our studios close in proximity, but myself being a student and practitioner of physical theater, I'm very much inspired by the visual, and her vision and intuition is laser sharp. And so I am always appreciative with the opportunity to work with her. And this is the first time we've collaborated on something together in this facet. But she speaks a language that I can understand. And so when she speaks in images, like, that's how I conceptualize things too.
Explain that a little bit, because yeah, because playwright, people think about the words in a script, but there is such a strong visual component as far as what's happening on the stage.
Right. So I hardly call myself a playwright. I call myself a generative performing artist or a deviser of theater, because I think about images. I think about people in space and time and movement. And Peregrine, as a visual artist, you know, not only in her illustrations, but in her words. She's an amazing poet. Like, she can paint pictures with words that are
Very few words.
That's exactly it. And so, like, the economy of language is something that I can relate to, because in physical theater, I really think about the economy of movement. Like, this is essential. Like, what is essential? And so, she's a great curator. And curator's kind of just about, like, scraping away the fat. We call it, like, trimming the fat. And just, like, getting to the essence of truth, which is, like, what artists want to do. This is the truth we want to tell today.
Right, jump in.
I think that's great. What you just said,
it's
great. Because I think of myself as, when I'm writing a play, I think of the music of the piece. Mm-hmm. I think of myself as an audience member. Would I pay $5 to see this play? So, it's more than just words on the paper. There's a lot of collaboration for someone who wants to be a successful, in your mind, playwright, I think.
Mm-hmm. We're going to get to Rye's performance in the Fringe Festival in just a second. But first, Heidi, tell me about the other play that you've got coming up, because it's called Love Me Tinder.
Yes. Love Me Tinder is also a new play devised by my fish turns, which are my yearly crop of interns and acting apprentices that I could not function without, especially during the Fringe Festival season. This year I have 8 of them, and I was inspired to create this piece based on one of my former interns, Elisa Lynn, would post these screenshots of her conversations on Tinder. And being an older woman.
Yeah, let's explain it, because I would not know about it if not for
the young
hearing
kids.
People talking about it.
Yes, so Tinder, I believe it's a line in our play. It's a app that, based on your location, matches you with other singles in your area.
Who happen to be nearby right then.
So I think that's terrifying. But that's something that people engage in all the time. And they meet them. And they go out with them. And all sorts of things can happen. And
there's what sounds like kind of a cruel process of swiping to the left. Like, you don't like the picture you see, you just swipe to the left.
And then if somebody swipes on you, there's this ding. And so, well, I don't know if that's the ding. That's the ding we use in our sound. That's our sound cue ding. But that attraction that you have when you meet someone wherever, and your eyes sparkle and you get all silly inside, that now can be stimulated by a sound, not even like seeing another person in a room. And I think that's weird. And so that's why I wanted to make a play about that, because it's like, what social conditioning are we taking away, those feelings and the love and just touch? And
so who are the characters in Love Me Tinder?
Well, the characters are young 20-somethings, and they're basically based off of the individual actors. So there's 3 men and 5 women. Just my interns: Shay, Roz, Brian, Sarah, oh my god, Jake, Joseph, Taylor, oh dear, Dury.
Yay. You got it. Well, so those are the characters, and that's Love Me Tinder.
That's Love Me Tinder.
Rye, what about you? In Fringe this year, you're performing in Presidential Briefs.
Presidential Briefs? It's what it sounds like. No. I've written 44 songs about every president to be performed in under an hour.
So that's amazing.
Thank
under
you
an
much.
Hour.
The entire so that's basically the entire history of the United States post-revolution.
In
an hour.
In an hour.
What's your favorite presidential song in the bunch?
The one I was singing on the way to the station was about Rutherford B. Hayes. It just rocks for 40 seconds. And then we're
I hate to put you on the spot. Are you willing to sing the Rutherford B. Hayes song?
Sure, a little bit. Oh, God. Okay. He was a lawyer in the know. Everybody loved him in Ohio. He became a gov after he was a rep. Now there only was one more step. Grant moved out, and in he went to become the 19th U.S. president. There's a little more of it.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Is there one song for each term? So if somebody has 2 terms, or did you just do one song about each president?
Each president.
Good question, Heidi.
Now, Grover Cleveland was president twice, not consecutively.
Mm-hmm.
So I reprise the song. So you music lovers and lovers of the presidents, please come to
Cleveland.
President. Yes.
Why did you want to do this? But why did you want to do this?
I had a funny idea. And I took it seriously. I took it seriously to write these songs, whether it's a rock song or a country song. Historically accurate, that was important to me. Now, if it was an eccentric fact about a president, that's in the song. Because, these dead white guys were pretty strange, some of them.
Yeah. What is the strangest detail about one of these, as you put it, dead white guys that you have included in one of your songs?
Can we take that out? No, we're not. Okay.
Live.
Let's see. I did write about Jimmy Carter. It's a country song, and the only actual fact about Jimmy Carter that I include is that he did an interview with Playboy, and he said he committed adultery in his heart. And so there's a country ballad based on that quote.
Aw, Jimmy Carter, I never knew. Well, so when did you get into theater?
In college, I think I played some funny roles. And then as a senior, I was Hamlet in college. So I went from Hamlet to playing Curious George at Theater for Young America. And now I'm writing songs about the presidents.
I remember your role in Curious George being described by a local critic as that you moved across the stage with, and I quote, simian grace. Can you talk? I mean, the difference between playing Hamlet and playing Curious George, can you talk about the range of things that interest you and how you connect with such different roles?
Well, Curious George, it was the script. It was really the script of having nothing to say and moving across the... No. I don't know. It's fun. I mean, theater is fun, whether it's serious stuff or historical or funny. I think Heidi and I understand the joy of creating, so that's why I love it.
What are your favorite kinds of projects to take on?
Two recent plays that I wrote. One is called Not Just for the Birds. It was an aviation history play for family audiences, and I didn't know anything about aviation history, but I was called to do this from a higher plane.
But seriously, who does make these kinds of calls to playwrights to offer them work? I don't know.
I think it was years ago, the Theater for Young America. They they commissioned me to write a piece, and I was like, yep, I'll do it. I'll find out about aviation history. So I wrote that from a kind of a childlike point of view. I also wrote a play about the Canterbury Tales. That was a rock musical that was at Kansas City Fringe just a few years ago. I did know a little about the Canterbury Tales, but I like taking on projects that have barriers in a way. Does that make sense?
That have parameters.
Yeah. Just like, can I do this?
It seems like research is also excites you.
I think it does.
Well. Yeah.
I think it does.
Like diving into something new rather than something, like people always say, write from what you know. Mm-hmm. And that's like, well, what do I know? You know, but like I like too, like finding out something completely new about something.
So that, do you think that is what would characterize sort of an experimental approach versus maybe a straight ahead or more mainstream approach, that there's this idea of the unknown being just a crucial part of the process?
I think that definitely brands something as more experimental than, and I use this word a lot, pedestrian, but like pedestrian is kind of something that we know and that's something we're familiar with than like a pedestrian play. Something that stretches the form of theater itself, something that stretches the idea, or I guess it's even experimental when you look at an artist and it's like, this is outside of my comfort, so it's more of an experiment in that way as well.
That's great. I think I approach plays differently than I did 10 years ago when I was starting to write. Well, okay, here's Edward Albee. I need to write these characters just like this. And I think...
So trying to emulate people you admired.
I think that's how artists start.
Yeah. How did you start the process of finding your own voice as separate from someone who you had admired and looked up to? And
I think it comes back to, you know, what do I want to sit in the theater and watch someone say these words? I think it's important to be entertained as an entertainer.
What is the real significance of Fringe, of this festival, for both of you? I mean, just in the real substance of the work you do.
I think it's a great platform to get your work out to a wide group of potential patrons. The Fish Tank has its list of its loyal supporters, The Fish Tank, which is my theater in the Crossroads. But at the Fringe Festival, my pieces will be at the Unicorn. There's more seats available. And just like the fact that the word about the projects that I'm doing will go to this wide audience, and then hopefully I can reel them in to become fans of experimental work all year long by having them patronize the Fish Tank.
Fringe is fantastic in that as an artist, you learn what it means to be an artist, which is not just creating your work, but promoting your work, producing your work. You learn really quickly because you've paid to be in the festival and you want to put people in the seats. So you learn how to use social media. You learn how to go out on the street and go, hey, I did this. It's not as much bragging as, hey, I created this. I need to. I made an investment.
And speaking of investment, like, it's money. Like, it's you. It's the best way to learn how to produce on a very small scale because it takes real dollars and cents from your idea to the day that the lights go out on your show. Like, it's an investment. And the things that I create, I don't ever want to happen just once. Like, I create things to be reproduced and to be sold. So I think of my theater as products, my experiments. Hopefully they get refined, and then it's like a stamp of approval, and let's send it out in the universe and someone else can do it.
Great. Yeah.
So in that process, though, is part of the reality that you learn to sort of work with a reality of competing with other performers in your market? Because there are so many performances in this festival. Mm-hmm. I cannot imagine being able to see them all or to be able to like truly engage with that many as a really involved audience member.
It's always intimidating, super intimidating, because there are like everybody brings their A game. I mean, that thing we just heard on the way, the opening of the show, like, I know we were looking at each other, like,
it was great.
Oh no, who's that? You know, it's like, that's where you kind of like elbow up next to your colleagues and new people emerge and show things that you had no idea that they were capable of. And my mind is blown. And then I ask them to come and do it later at the Fish Tank. I'm like, come and do that again.
Yeah. I think, yes, of course, the artist can't see everybody's work. But there is there's a community spirit. I mean, we like that we're all doing this work, and like Heidi said, it's great to see new faces, hear new voices. I think that's wonderful.
What would you guys say are the prospects for upward mobility, like in your career in Kansas City?
With presidential briefs, there's an election year coming up next year. I think I treat this like a product as well. Maybe this can have legs after this. So,
what would legs mean? Would that mean that it gets exported to other cities to
sure.
be performed by other people, or for you to travel and tour?
I'm performing it at Fringe as a history teacher who sings rock songs. But this absolutely can be performed by someone else. I think as a playwright, that's my goal, to say, okay, here it is. Like you said, here it is for the world. Next month, I'm going to perform it at the National Farmers Market on the Mall in D.C. So hopefully I can generate some buzz there.
So am I understanding correctly that upward mobility for a Kansas City playwright, in your view, or at least for you, is about making yourself an exportable kind of product?
Sure, because we all can't go to New York and struggle for 10, 15 years. I've struggled in Kansas City for 10 to 15 years. So, I think it's about making that product sellable. Mm-hmm.
I think I agree with you. And it's also what I admire about you is your commissions. You know, my goal is to have a body of work. You know, I write grants. I support myself through other various means. But it's to also be commissioned to generate work. Community-based work, like mine, tend to be with social issues or conversations about that, and they're more curatorial and conversation-based. So to be invited to go somewhere and be an exportable, I'd like to be exportable.
Hey, great.
Central Standard is off to a quick break. If you're a theater lover or aspiring theater professional, call us up, tell us what you'd like to see more of and what you might like to see a little less of, what we're doing well as a theater town and maybe not so well. The number's 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. Good morning. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is Central Standard. The Fringe Festival is gearing up for its 11th season in Kansas City, so we're getting to know the community behind all those original plays you'll be seeing. Our guests are Heidi Van, who runs a small black box theater called The Fish Tank, and Rye Kincaid, a performer and playwright who works all over town. Heidi, tell us more about The Fish Tank. What's your mission over there?
The Fish Tank is a place to create, edit, and debut ideas. Material performed at the Fish Tank is fresh, its content progressive, and its artists and performers committed to the aesthetic of risk-taking and failure. Producing, oh, you guys, I've lost the rest of it. keeping work so fresh and the turnover, it prepares audiences for more of that. So, like, presenting raw material keeps the patrons in Kansas City kind of prepared and willing to invest in that experience. That
what do you mean by raw material?
That it hasn't been tested in other markets. A lot of the new works that, the Rep and the Coterie and the Unicorn bring in have had a debut in another region by a national playwright. National probably meaning they're from New York, mm-hmm. more than likely, or Chicago or L.A.
And people probably don't realize how much things are retooled after they debut.
And a lot of them, because of the connections that those theaters have, a lot of them are retooled in our town, which is amazing that, like, Kansas City artists, producers to PAs, like the whole gamut of the theatrical ecosystem, we all have an effect on these works as they go back out into different communities. And so the Fish Tank on a micro level is I do that with local artists. Artists, with local playwrights and also playwrights that I have connections with from other regions who want a platform for their work to be developed, classmates of mine from Del Arte, or things I find on the internet that I'm like, I would like to work on this in Kansas City.
It was great. Heidi invited me to test out some short plays or scenes, and that was a great experience. It's to have something on your feet. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate the fact that artists are willing to contribute the work mm-hmm. for the mission, because mm-hmm. it's for the mission.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, what is the value of taking something that is still in this raw experimental phase and putting it in front of an audience? I mean, what is the value not just for the performer, but for the audience member?
Hopefully, if the programming is correct, if a person picked something that's compelling and interesting, it's testing the form of theater. Will this work? Is mm-hmm. this where we're going? Is this where we're headed? And that's why I go and see new plays, because as theater is evolving and playwrights are evolving and you're inspired by what you see, it's like, is this a way that we can communicate, especially now in this like virtual technological age?
Mm-hmm. It's valuable for me to hear the rhythm of the work. I associate music with playwriting a lot.
Of course.
Even if there's not music involved. It's wondering if jokes land, if the theme is followed through. You can't just get that from a page or having somebody read your play.
Mm-hmm. Heidi, you mentioned especially in this technological age, this is important. Mm-hmm. Why is it especially important in the midst of the technology that surrounds us?
Well, the fact that we receive so many images per second. And that's the main reason why at the beginning of my career that I primarily developed physical-based theater, because we're used to receiving information like as photographs or just in really short sentences. But in our mind, we'll finish the sentence. We know what people are going to say. We're an intelligent community.
World. Oh,
right.
Community.
World.
Right. Okay, okay.
We
I was trying to
world.
Finish your
I know. I didn't know what it was. That's why I don't use words in my plays. So, but with physical theater, the audience in some ways can kind of go on their own narrative. They can invest their own, because not that it's not specific, the movement that happens or the story that's intended to be told, but it keeps the mind activated and you're thinking and you're analyzing and you're going somewhere and then you're surprised, because words sometimes can't surprise you, but movements can.
Heidi, I have seen some of your performances and I've been to the Fish Tank and I get a feeling, I mean, you talk about how physical the work is and I know what you mean, but there's also what I feel like is a very literary quality to your work. It seems like almost like you're reading a collection of short stories, often little vignettes, mm-hmm. and the feeling that you come away with is that you've just curled up with a book. And you know how when you read a book, you get these kind of vague and disconnected, but narrative images in your mind of the characters who are playing these things out. It's got that intimate, curled up with the book kind of quality.
I think that, well, the space has that quality because it's intimate and your experience is very personal. You're close to the other patrons and you're close to the actors. But also many of the evenings, they are these little compact, different vignettes, different styles. This is a poem. This is a movement piece. This is a story. This is an actually scripted play. Here's just a fact. You know, so it does have a lot of different components that hopefully... that's what I like to do. I was a history major, and I like to study things, put them all together, and see what happens.
Do all the experiments work in your theater?
Oh, no. No. Sometimes they don't work at all. And that's where you risk, fail, risk again. Mm-hmm. And you learn from why it didn't work. I think that's the most important thing. If something doesn't work, just to know why.
Let's talk about this a little bit more, because this idea of risk taking, I think, is really important to this discussion. First of all, like the risk of even opening this theater. Can you spell out what was at stake in that decision to open a small black box experimental theater where you're testing raw material in what is increasingly kind of a high rent neighborhood, the Crossroads District?
Yes, absolutely. So at first it was a financial decision and investment. If artists aren't going to pay to use my space, how am I going to generate revenue to support this space for the opportunity for these artists? And so that's when I really got into curating experiences and inviting a community to come and participate. And I would offer themes and we'd have these curated nights of performance. So that was a risk. Also, your decision making becomes scrutinized. Like, I'm doing something, I'm charging people money to come and see it. Like, I need to make really good decisions on programming and operational procedures. And all of a sudden you become an artistic director or a curator or someone who has the ability to shape a season and offer a selection to people. And so there's a lot of overwhelming.
It sounds hard. Theater is hard.
Theater is hard. It's so hard. And it takes a lot of people and it takes a lot of money and a lot of time. Mm-hmm. Like, it never stops. The theater never sleeps. There's like a million things to do at the fish tank right now, I'm sure. Hopefully somebody's doing them. Otherwise, it'll be me. And then I expanded this year. I now have the fish tank proper, which is the black box theater. I have the Groffice, which is a green room and office. It's for actors to hang out. Then I have the white room, which is my office, and mainly because it's painted white. And then I took over the upstairs space because it became available, and now I don't have to worry about feet above heads of audience members. So, hey, everyone, there's no audio distraction from upstairs. And then it has a small office that I've turned into a micro residency for traveling artists.
How did you expand in that way? I mean, just from a practical standpoint, how did you do that?
What do you mean? How did I do that? Like, the space became available, so I took it? Or what was my
idea
behind it?
Well, I mean, I guess almost you explained all of the financial challenges.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
How did you meet those challenges?
Well, I am a grateful recipient of the Robert Rauschenberg Foundation Seed Grant, which is an anonymously nominated award that three other organizations in Kansas City got. And so that's a three-year grant of $10,000 a year, which is great, which is actually to shore up your infrastructure, you pay off past debts, kind of. It's for startups, arts organizations, so that you can get over the hurdles that other small arts organizations have, which are huge. And like $10,000 a year sounds like a lot, and it's so not, like in terms of what I just did to the fish tank. So, but it also gives me time. So time to properly program, time to set up how I want each of these spaces to function. And then hopefully the time that affords me, my programming can really generate a lot of revenue to maintain and sustain the space.
So it sounds like you met your challenges and you handled your risks by becoming a business person while being an artist.
Yeah.
Right. Can you talk to me a little bit more generally about opportunities for risk taking in Kansas City's theater scene?
Let's see. I don't know. It's working. You just gotta keep working. You gotta develop relationships with people like Heidi.
Who are other people like Heidi?
Well, let's see. V. Tran is an excellent artist slash business person. There's so much to learn from someone like him or Heidi about being an artist today. It took me 10 years or so to be like, oh, well, I wrote this. Nobody's coming to my door to see my work. It's about being out there, and it's inspirational, people like V and Heidi, to see them working. And it tells me, get to work if you want people to pay attention to your work.
Are there any kinds of things that you would like to be able to try out that there it just isn't a venue for?
I'm grateful to, just in the past month, I've been accepted as one of the members of the Midwest Dramatists Center.
Cool.
Thank you very much. There are only about seven of us now, I think, and their goal is to take emerging playwrights and to help them become established playwrights. They meet at the Writer's Place for readings. It's a support group for playwrights,
which is important.
It is important. So I'm anxious to find ways to develop work with them.
So it sounds like you are finding opportunities to get the kind of mentoring you want and the kinds of performance venues you're looking for.
I think so. It's really, we're lucky in Kansas City in that there it's a small group of artists who work hard, and if fellow artists see each other working hard, it's contagious.
What is your sense of where we are with theater in Kansas City right now? Do you feel like it's an art form that's grown or evolved in recent years?
It has grown. You can definitely read articles in the Star about it. You can hear people talk about it. The Crossroads is obviously developing. But I don't think it's oversaturated. Theater's theater. I think it's great to see the experimental, see what's out there.
I just recently wrote an article about if Kansas City was a theater town and kind of evaluating what other theater towns are, which would be Boston, New York, Chicago, Minneapolis, LA, places where theater is a viable entertainment option to the masses, if I may say.
And I take as an implication in that that's not yet the case in
Kansas
City.
Not yet the case.
Why not?
Well, I asked a variety of people. I asked artistic directors, and I asked actors, and as far as from the artist side, it is. Mm-hmm. It's we're there. We have lots of opportunity. It happens a lot. The quality and integrity of what we produce and present is high, mm-hmm. and there's experimental work and new work being generated out of the independent theater houses in town, as well as national tours, world premieres, equity houses. It's all happening. What we need to be a theater town is that theater is a viable entertainment option. I'm going to go to the Royals game. I'm going to go to the Chiefs game. I'm going to go to Power and Light. I'm going to go to the theater.
Hmm.
I'm going to listen to jazz. I'm going to eat barbecue. I'm going to go to the theater.
That's great.
Central Standards headed to one last break. When we return, why theater matters. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. And we're back. Hi again, Rye Kincaid.
Hello.
And welcome back, Heidi Van.
Hello.
We've been discussing experimental theater in Kansas City this hour. And guys, we have not totally defined experimental theater. I'd like to do that. And then I'd like to get back to this question of Kansas City as a theater town. So, Heidi, take your stab at experimental theater definition.
I believe experimental theater is a performance in which challenges typical ideas of theater execution and absorption mm-hmm. by the audience.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
I've written a song about each president, and there's lots of history and lots of humor. Is it a play? I don't know. But
yeah, what's
is
happening visually when you do that?
It's me as a history teacher, but every word out of my mouth is a lyric from these 44 songs. So I come from an educator background. I thought, well, this is, I could present it like this. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, is it a proper play? I don't know, but it is theater.
So if you have that question, maybe it's experimental.
There you go.
The penis monologues, like, it's one of those same question. I'm like, is this a play? It's an experiment. So, I mean, that. So I think we're both in the same boat on that. Like, what? Like, how do you define this, what we're about to do?
Is it a distinction that matters?
Not if it's good.
Yeah, I'm
quality matters.
Yeah, yeah, I'm
quality,
coming to terms with.
Absolutely.
I'm coming to terms with.
Experience.
I wrote this, but I don't know if it's a play.
Well, let's get back to this question of Kansas City. Heidi, you've written an article asking, what if Kansas City was a theater town, which implies that it is not quite yet. What's the importance of original theater and a theater community, a theater-going community, to a city's overall, like, health and well-being or cosmopolitanness, whatever you consider?
Well, I think it's important because those are the players in your community. Those are the players in your city. Like, you, those are the artists that you follow, just like we're a team. I grew up an athlete, so a lot of what I do, I associate to, like, a team or a roster. Like, these are the people. These are the names that we know, and we support them because we know that their work also represents our city on a macro level, like, maybe worldwide. So I think that if you have a town where you just import theater, like, that's cool, and you can watch it as a spectator, which is also cool. But when you get involved, like, you have on a Sporting KC hat, like, you know the players, you know where they studied, or you know where they played before, you know what they've been, and you're following the trajectory of their career. And they, like, they make the team better because they're here and you traded for them. Like, that's exciting. And I think that's exciting in the, like, artistic eco culture.
You know, in sports, people talk about fair weather fans, and there's this sense that you are loyal to your team no matter how they're doing. Do you think that that should apply to the arts? Because that's something that I go back and forth on myself, because there's a part of me that wants to support everything, and there's a part of me that thinks the public almost gets miseducated by treating the good and the bad like it's all one thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's like being a KU basketball fan. They should be the best basketball team in the country because it was originated there. Anyway, I digress. But yeah, it's like, even though maybe this performance or this institution, like, isn't at the level that they have been, like, they're risking. And so that's where the experiment comes in, and the risk comes in. It's like, bear with us through this, or bear with this show or this production, no matter what, if it's professional or amateur. Like, you can't judge all of it the same.
And I think, you know, it's, I don't want to say pity the artist, but a theater artist puts in lots of time, lots of emotion, sometimes lots of money for a product. And for an audience member to go, yeah, it was all right, or it was bad, it was good, that's fine, but...
So it's like, push your players, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what about just an idea that's come up already, but what is the role of theater in a world with so much storytelling? I mean, the amount of media, like, acting, fictional world-making we consume in an ordinary day just is unprecedented. Does that put new demands on theater?
Yes. Like, we can look at our phones and see stories. Or see a picture and look at the story. So we have to be smarter in a way that we don't – I don't know if I understand yet. You know, there's a way of communication that, you know, I break it down, and it's like, what's their attention span? What, you know, like
– I most definitely think about that. You know, as an audience member, I probably don't want to sit through a two-act play anymore.
No, anymore, for real. And then, like, generationally, like, you know, age of patrons and this new generation of people who are only used to these things. And and so it's like, how can I get them to come and be and fall in love with the theater like I did?
What does live theater offer that your gadget can't?
Space and time and breath, energy.
That's beautiful.
Right?
Sure, yeah.
Lights.
Yeah. It's live.
It's live.
It's like, it's a connection, right?
Yeah.
Is the goal of experimental theater to become mainstream someday, to eventually, like, bleed into the taste and consciousness of more people? Or is the idea to stay on the fringe and to keep challenging the institution of theater perpetually?
Well, the one example I think of is like Blue Man Group.
Mm-hmm.
It was an experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's in Las Vegas. So you can be weird and then be in Las Vegas, if you can get my analogy from that. So, but then it's also like, well, let's go back to zero and be this thing again. And then see if mm-hmm. we can put it in like the common vocabulary of like, this is what theater is. Blue Man Group is now theater. And as for a physical theater artist, that's rad.
Mm-hmm. Well, Shakespeare was experimental, right? I mean, it all starts as something new, something risky.
Uh-huh.
But if it speaks, you know, that's what live theater. Let's go back to that. That's what live theater is great about. It's a communication. You have a storyteller and a listener in the audience.
Well, I mean, thinking about someplace like Boston or New York, which Heidi, you were mentioning those as true theater towns. What do you think? I mean, how do the other arts in those cities benefit from the vibrance of the theater going like tradition?
Just by probably conversation, being involved in like being something that people do, and that conversation stimulates people to experience other artistic opportunities to fulfill a part of themselves in a cultural way that they may not have experienced before, or that those people in those specific cities, like, that's part of what makes their city. That's part of what makes their experience.
What do you think are the challenges to Kansas City becoming that kind of place? Or do you see a pathway toward that reality?
I'm trying to figure that out. I don't know the answer, but that's what drives me every day to keep doing what I'm doing, is to our city doesn't have to be validated. Our city is amazing. Kansas City theater is amazing. You know, the people who work in this town or have worked in this town or come from out of town, it's amazing and I love it. And my mission is to share that with people and figure out how to do that while at the same time satisfying my artistic side, because a lot of times I don't get to be an artist. Like, I decided to go to fancy business school and learn how to sell theater to the masses. And so, but I like doing that too.
Well, if you think about, like, when I think about musicians, for example, they say that the best way to improve is to play with people who are better than they are.
Yeah.
So in that spirit, like, thinking about Kansas City, Heidi, who's better than you? Who do you love to collaborate with? Who, like, makes you better?
I love to collaborate with Peregrine. I love to collaborate with Vanessa Severo. I love to collaborate with Kyle Hatley and Jeff Church. And actually, anyone who's like, I want to work with you. I was talking to Chip Miller last night, and he's like, I want, and I'm like, oh, I would love that. Like,
so these are names for people in Kansas City to be looking out for.
Yeah, these are our players.
Mm-hmm. You know? What do they have coming up that you're looking forward to?
Well, oh my gosh, everyone that I mentioned. Well, Vanessa Severo's in the Penis Monologues, which I'm super excited about. And Chip Miller is part of the Kansas City Repertory Theater, and all of those plays that are produced there are engaging and new and cutting edge in a way. Jeff Church, the artistic director of the Coterie, is my mentor. So I follow him. And then Peregrine and I are working on the Penis Monologues.
Mm-hmm. Rye, what are you looking forward to?
What am I looking forward to?
In
lunch?
Theater.
Oh, no. Okay. I don't know. It is exciting. I think since working on this new piece about the presidents, I've reconnected with some people I haven't worked with in a long time. Not necessarily working with them, but going, hey, I'm doing this. What are you doing? And you're like, oh, yeah, we used to be pals in the theater. So it's fun to reconnect in this small but vibrant theater community.
So you're looking forward to some collaborations.
Definitely. The director of Presidential Briefs is Annie Cherry. She's a funny and sensual burlesque dancer. I thought she could add something to my show that I couldn't. So she can do no wrong.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's show. It's been really fun talking with you both. We'll continue the discussion. Heidi Vann of the Fish Tank Theater, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And playwright and composer Rye Kincaid, thanks to you too.
Thanks very much.
Heidi Vann's Love Me Tinder and the Penis Monologues will be at the Fringe Festival this weekend, and you can see Rye Kincaid in Presidential Briefs. Go to kcfringe.org for more information. To listen back to this discussion, just go to kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have it available by the end of the day. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, an intentional Christian community in Missouri has been a godsend for some, helping people find new life and recovery, but others say the environment is abusive. Hear that story tomorrow on Central Standard. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Special thanks to Julie Deneche for her help today. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.